With 90% of all Texans on lockdown, what of the 10% mostly in rural Texas? A warning about an unseen spread eluding detection today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. More on what researchers are saying about the unchecked community spread of COVID-19 in the Lone Star State. Also, reports of an increase in domestic violence as Texans are trying to cope with stay-at-home rules. The growing gap over what to do about health concerns for those behind bars right now. And after a big tree is cut down in West Texas, why a family won't let it go. Those stories and a whole lot more when the Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 7th day of April. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. We're going to try to begin this Tuesday with a few news items not related to a certain virus and a lockdown you may already be familiar with. Item number one, the Texas Tribune is reporting that the president of the University of Texas won't be much longer. Sources tell the Trib that this week, Gregory Fenves is expected to announce he's leaving the flagship University of Texas for Emory in Atlanta. Item number two, gas prices have long been falling. Not great news for many in Texas involved in production, and not a positive sign for the economy. But if you're filling up your tank in Port Arthur, Gas Buddy reports you're enjoying the lowest fill-ups in all of Texas, an eye-popping 99 cents per gallon. The first time that's happened in Texas for quite a while. The last time the national average was below a buck, we didn't know what smartphones were, and we certainly didn't have broadband internet. The year was 1999. Looking for a great place to work? The annual Best Places to Work list is out for 2020. Highest ranking large Texas business, David Weekly Homes at number 17, the Houston-based company, the largest privately held builder of single-family homes. Some 96% of its employees called it a great place to work, compared to 59% of employees at a typical U.S.-based company. For the record, construction jobs have been far less affected by COVID-19 closures, but with hundreds of thousands of Texans now without work and unemployment claims overloading the state's ability to process all of them, sales are slowing and realtors are bracing for impact. Not all of Texas is affected equally, of course. As of Sunday, more than 100 Texas counties had not reported a single confirmed case of coronavirus, but there may be danger lurking in those numbers, specifically unseen community spread that's already happening. This according to an analysis of the spread of the virus by a group of UT researchers, including Dr. Spencer J. Fox, a statistical epidemiology research associate at the University of Texas at Austin. He's one of the authors of a new report on undetected transmission of COVID-19. Dr. Fox, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
This report suggests that COVID-19 cases are largely spreading undetected, I presume because there aren't enough tests, or what's going on?
Yeah, there's really two factors for the undetected spread. The first one is that we know that there is a high proportion of individuals who have subclinical infections, meaning they get the disease but don't show up at a doctor's office because it may be mild, or they may just not have any symptoms. And then the second one is kind of the shortage of testing, and anyone who's tried to get a COVID test has experienced that firsthand.
One of the important lines in this report is that the immediate and long-term risk of the virus can be difficult to grasp given the lack of historical precedent and that many cases go undetected. What are you trying to communicate with this report? Can you explain what you mean by the immediate and long-term risk of the virus being difficult to grasp?
With the report, we're trying to give evidence to county health officials to make a tough decision. I mean, county public health officials right now are weighing the economic costs of a major shutdown with the public health costs of potential community spread that is going on in their community. And our report is helping them make that decision by saying that even if you're not seeing that many cases, you're seeing one or two cases in your county, it's more likely than not that you have underlying community transmission.
What I understand is that you believe that there could be a 9% chance that community-wide spread is occurring even in a county or town that has no cases of COVID-19. Do I have that right?
Yes.
How do you come up with that 9% figure?
Yeah, 9%. So The absolute number of 9% is based on some kind of simple modeling assumptions we've made, but they are grounded in the truth that we know for a fact that COVID is everywhere at this point. It's spreading so rapidly across the US, it would be very unlikely for a COVID case to not have appeared in any county in the US at this point. And so using those assumptions, we could then estimate how likely it is that that single imported case into a county causes an epidemic. It's very similar to the type of approach we used for understanding silent spreading during the Zika epidemic in 2016.
So for an official who's trying to figure out, okay, what do I do with this information? On the one hand, I have no reported cases of COVID-19. On the other hand, these researchers at UT are telling me that that's still going on in my community. What do I do? How do I balance economic interests with public health concerns at this point, at this juncture?
I think at this point in time, if you are a county public health official who has not enacted stringent non-pharmaceutical interventions in your region, our study helps you understand that there is still a risk for community spread, even if you haven't seen detected cases. And by the time you see one or two cases, it may already be to the point that you have widespread community transmission.
We're going to have a link to some of the top line findings in this research. Dr. Spencer J. Fox is a statistical epidemiology research associate at UT Austin and one of the co-authors of this new report. Dr. Fox, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
In the past few days, we've reported on concerns about the spread of COVID-19 behind bars in Texas, including outbreaks in the populations of Texas's two largest cities. But what to do? Some are calling for reducing the numbers of people incarcerated, that is, letting people go. Others say that move could be more harmful to the health of the general population. As KERA's Christopher Connolly reports, the divide echoes a familiar one in Texas, one between state and local officials.
Governor Greg Abbott says all this talk of letting people out of jail made some people nervous, so he wanted to reassure Texans that public safety is still paramount.
So I am issuing an executive order to stop the release of dangerous felons from prisons and jails in Texas.
The order blocks early release for people serving jail sentences for violent crimes or giving them alternatives like electronic monitoring.
Releasing dangerous criminals from jails into the streets is not the right solution.
The governor didn't stop with people who've been convicted of crimes. He also addressed people who've been arrested, who are legally innocent and waiting for trial. At the beginning of March, 63% of people in Texas jails had been arrested but not convicted. Now, this is where things get a little bit complicated. After you're arrested, a judge will tell you how much cash bail you need to pay in order to get out of jail. If you've got the money, you pay your bond and you go home. But if you don't have the cash, you can get stuck in jail. So there's been talk of using personal bonds to get people out of jail who can't come up with bail money. It's basically a promise to show up on your court date and stay out of trouble. But the governor's order makes it illegal to give personal bonds to people arrested for violent crimes or for threatening violence. Same, too, for people arrested for low-level crimes who had previously committed a violent crime.
Well, I obviously don't agree with Governor Abbott's order. It makes no sense to me.
Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins says, imagine you're a cash-flush gang member charged with violent crimes. You've got bail money.
You can get out. But if you're a poor person, you have to stay in jail.
Another Dallas County Democrat, District Attorney John Cruzeau, says he's not even sure the order's legal or enforceable.
I'm not sure that it really has any practical impact in Dallas so far. It hasn't changed a thing.
Politics aside, county officials across Texas have reduced jail populations in the face of COVID-19. In some places, that's meant letting people out who have just a short time left on their sentences or moving people to probation. It also means bringing in fewer people in the first place. Police departments are giving more citations and making fewer arrests.
I think that we're going to learn very quickly that we can implement a lot of these measures without putting public safety at risk.
Michelle Deitch is a UT Austin law professor who's advising jails on coronavirus preparations.
And in fact, it will reduce the risk to public safety by reducing the spread of the illness.
Even with policy changes to reduce the potential for coronavirus spread, social distancing in jails just isn't possible, either for the people who are locked up or for the guards. Everything from meals to showers are shared, and a bottle of Purell, it might be contraband.
On top of that, you're dealing with a medically vulnerable population. Most people who are incarcerated in jails tend to have a slew of medical problems.
Higher rates of chronic conditions like asthma or diabetes, higher rates of drug and alcohol abuse and cigarette smoking, and oftentimes a history of inadequate health care that frankly doesn't get much better once they're locked up, Deitch says. When you add it all up, jails are kind of the perfect environment for a virus to thrive.
And that's why this is such a desperate situation and such an urgent need to reduce those populations as quickly as possible.
That, she says, is the responsibility of every player in the justice system. I'm Christopher Connolly in Fort Worth.
Wells Dunbar is our social media editor. Let's find out what he's seeing online. What are Texans talking about on this Tuesday, Wells?
Hi, David. Well, we've been talking about the undetected spread of COVID-19 here on the show and how a scarcity of tests makes containing the coronavirus harder. We were curious if any of our friends and listeners have actually been tested for COVID-19, and if so, how difficult it was to actually get a test. We've had a few folks confirming that they were able to be tested, but several others complaining that they or their friends were not able. On Facebook, Missy writes that, "I know 5 people who have been presumed positive. None were tested. No tests were available at the time. One had to go to the ER and be put on an inhaler, but ultimately none were hospitalized." L writes that, "My husband and infant son were tested, but a fat lot of good the testing did them. The results took so long that both of their first tests were voided due to a lab error." And lastly, Jennifer says that, "We had symptoms and still couldn't get a test. It seems like one needs to be in the secret society to be tested." Hopefully those conditions change as more testing is rolled out nationwide and statewide, David. Just one story we're watching. I'll be back with more later in the show.
Indeed. Hey, listen, we would love to know what's making news in your part of Texas. Tweet us at Texas Standard. Coming up, how lockdown is affecting domestic violence across the Lone Star State. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Everyone's trying to cope one way or another with stay-at-home orders, but for some, the effect of this can be dangerous and life-threatening in an altogether different way. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Trovall says amid the COVID-19 lockdown, Texas nonprofits are reporting an uptick in domestic violence.
So I'm just returning your phone call.
At her dining room table in Northeast Houston, Wendy Arias calls back people who've requested help with family violence.
So from what I'm seeing is that you're looking for divorce with custody, correct?
Arias is a client advocate with AVDA, Aid to Victims of Domestic Abuse. It's more important than ever Arias quickly reach out to women. The group saw an uptick in calls in March when social distancing started amid COVID-19. Here's AVDA's CEO, Maisha Coulter.
I think it's probably more dire than we even know.
Coulter says stay-at-home orders could make a domestic violence situation even worse.
We are sort of in a sanctioned isolation situation. So for most victims, they're being told to stay at home, and usually that means staying at home with their children and their abuser. And that's a dangerous circumstance in any situation, but especially for victims. Perpetrators tend to use isolation just in general as a way to assert their power and control over their victims.
To get an idea what's happening now, just look back to 2017 and Hurricane Harvey and what happened to Faith Graves, who asked us to change her name.
We were stuck at home. We couldn't go to work. So we were there together and I didn't feel safe.
Graves says she was living with her husband and her two kids in the Katy area at the time.
And I snatched the laptop from him and he basically snatched it away from me and kicked me on my back. And we got into a huge fight and the kids were around.
Graves says she went to the hospital to see what was wrong.
And they did x-rays and everything. So it turned out that I had something wrong with my back when he kicked me.
Graves is now divorced, lives with her son, and says she's much happier. But it took years to get out of that relationship. What happened to Graves and thousands of others during Harvey is being used as a model for what to expect on a larger scale during COVID-19, says Gloria Terry, who runs the Texas Council on Family Violence, a coalition of providers statewide working with the victims of domestic violence.
There was an increase in frequency and severity of domestic violence. And so if you think about that, that was just a much smaller footprint, although it was an enormous footprint for Hurricane Harvey.
Terry says she's seen an increase in domestic violence across the state.
Agencies across the state are reporting to us that there's an increase in hotline calls just in the last 2 weeks.
And she suspects things will only get worse over time as stay-at-home orders are extended and people lose their jobs. Meanwhile, as shelters try to house fewer families to comply with social distancing standards, there will be even fewer beds for families in need. And Terry says bed capacity was already low to begin with.
So we already knew that in the state of Texas, 42% of requests for emergency shelter go unmet because of capacity issues. And in the Houston proper area, that percentage goes up to about 78%.
Terry says that means even if women and men call in to say they're ready to leave their abuser, they still might be denied emergency shelter. I'm Elizabeth Troval in Houston.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a health and safety-focused workers' compensation provider, reminding Texans that the best way to stick together right now is to stay apart. More at texasmutual.com/coronavirus.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. At school, students with disabilities often have a small army of support staff to keep them healthy and learning. Special education teachers, specialists, sometimes therapists. The coronavirus has thrown all that into disarray. By order of the governor, Texas public schools have been closed since March 23rd. Some stopped classes even earlier. Texas Public Radio's Camille Phillips reports now on how the sudden switch to distance learning has placed an additional burden on parents of these students.
The past few weeks have not been easy, even for homeschool veterans like Natchez Phelps of Houston.
I love homeschooling. I really, really do. I wasn't prepared for all of this.
Two of Phelps' three children have autism. Her 12-year-old, Alexander, uses an iPad to communicate. Most of his lessons focus on life skills. Before the outbreak, she'd take Alexander to several weekly therapy sessions. Phelps is trying to continue this therapy from home while teaching her two younger kids.
I am exhausted, and we're only getting through math right now. We haven't started reading yet.
Both parents and educators of students with disabilities say the abrupt shift to staying home makes everything more challenging and time-consuming, disrupting routines and making some things simply impossible. San Antonio mom Ashley Haugen says she's just trying to muddle through as best she can and find small moments of joy.
I don't want to be in a fruit salad.
Who is that?
Wally. Somebody please help me. Mm-hmm.
Her 3-year-old Kipley has autism, apraxia, and aphasia. Kipley loves to hear her preschool teacher read stories aloud on her tablet, and she loves wearing a purple princess dress instead of her school uniform.
She reading the story?
Yeah.
Haugen says her daughter's teachers have gone above and beyond to offer support, but it's still not an easy situation.
Do you think you'd be able to do it if you were working as well?
No, just being completely honest, no. I think if I was working as well, I think it'd be a lot more difficult.
Haugen's biggest concern now is that her daughter's progress in speech therapy will regress.
She's already kind of slid back when it comes to being able to say certain words.
She says there was a 3-week delay between school closing and the first time she heard from Kipley's speech-language pathologist.
I think that they're doing the best they can with what tools they have to work with. I think it's a really big challenge going from in-person doing speech therapy and doing teaching to then going online.
Her older daughter, Abigail, is dyslexic. While schools stay closed, both girls are now receiving 15 minutes of teletherapy a week. But Haugen says at school, Kipley normally received 30 minutes of group speech therapy twice a week. Even in the best circumstances, parents are left to fill in the gaps. 8-year-old Benjamin's school in San Antonio's Northside School District gave his mom, Priscilla Kelly, exercises to keep him active.
What does red mean?
Run around.
Oh, go, spin around, spin around.
Kelly says Benjamin was born 3 months early and had a traumatic brain injury when he was 3. At school, he received speech therapy, physical therapy, and occupational therapy.
Oh, I think the light stopped. Oh, good job. Oh, hold on.
Kelly says all three of his therapists have reached out through Google Classroom.
They've sent us a couple videos here and there. We really haven't had the time to go through it all.
It's been a challenge to navigate, though she was able to get Benjamin teletherapy through a local nonprofit.
At first, I was a little stressed out because it was like overwhelming. It was a lot of work, but we're slowly kind of getting the hang of it and adjusting.
Like all parents of students with disabilities, she has to balance her son's care with her own. Kelly's currently on dialysis, awaiting a kidney transplant.
That's why we're trying to get a lot of this going, and then Dad and his nurse are going to probably take over whenever I'm in the hospital and stuff.
Pandemic or no pandemic, life keeps moving. Kelly says they're trying to take it one day at a time and not put too much pressure on themselves. I'm Camille Phillips in San Antonio.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Governor Greg Abbott says residents at a nursing home along the Texas Gulf Coast are being treated for COVID-19 with a drug normally used to combat malaria. He discussed the latest at a news conference Monday.
About 30 patients are being tested with the hydroxychloroquine to determine whether or not it will be a successful treatment for those patients.
President Donald Trump has been promoting the drug as a treatment for COVID-19. However, medical experts caution clinical trials have not yet proven its effectiveness. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved its use on an emergency basis in certain cases. Meanwhile, Governor Abbott is ordering all state parks and historic sites to close to the public amid the coronavirus pandemic. The closures take effect at 5 tonight. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Department says in the meantime, employees will continue to maintain the sites and clean facilities. San Antonio is following a recommendation the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued last week that people wear cloth face coverings in public where it's hard to maintain social distancing. Texas Public Radio's Joey Palacios has more.
San Antonio Mayor Ron Nirenberg says the masks can be homemade out of bandanas or scarves, but that medical masks like N95s should not be used.
We don't want folks to think that they need surgical masks out in the public, and not only would that take away from the supplies that are needed in the hospital, it also will give people a false sense of security that they can do whatever they want.
Nirenberg says face coverings are not a substitute for hand washing, self-isolation, and social distancing. I'm Joy Palacios in San Antonio.
The state's pollution regulator is giving some leeway in enforcing violations that may be unavoidable during the pandemic. In a letter Monday, the chairman of the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality says that does not mean the agency has rolled back emission standards and reporting requirements. John Neerman explains TCEQ has discretion not to enforce rules on a case-by-case basis, including actions that could risk transmitting COVID-19. But Catherine Frazier with the nonprofit Environment Texas says that could make the outbreak worse for some people.
So we know that air pollution and other
forms of pollution impair lung function and weaken defense systems that guard against infection. And increasingly, experts are saying that people exposed to air pollution face a greater risk of contracting COVID-19 and experiencing severe symptoms.
The Environmental Protection Agency has also loosened pollution regulations during the public health crisis. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the online UT High School, offering a full-time diploma program and individual courses for students from any school. Courses can be started anytime to catch up or get ahead. Learn more at highschool.utexas.edu.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. There are certainly places in Texas with more cases of COVID-19 than Castro County, a rural area in the western panhandle, but on a per capita basis, the county's 10 reported positive cases and one death make it one of the most heavily affected areas of the state. Most of those cases come from a community called Nazareth. It's a town of about 300 people. County officials believe the virus may have spread during a high school basketball tournament in early March. Here to tell us more about how the community is faring is Bob Birkenfeld. He's a native of Nazareth and a deacon at Holy Family Catholic Church, the community's lone religious congregation. Deacon Birkenfeld, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit more about Nazareth itself. What kind of place is it?
Well, Nazareth is a German community founded back in the early 1900s. By our grandparents who came here, most of them from up north. So everyone here knows each other, like family. We go to school together. We go to church together. A lot of us are cousins. The people affected are the people that we see every day. And so real tight-knit. Everybody knows each other. I grew up in a family of 12. There
Wow.
was probably that. Three or four families that size, but otherwise, you know, 9 or 10 kids was pretty well the average.
This is in a way affecting folks in the family directly. What has it felt like to be living in Nazareth for the past few weeks?
Well, you look at people in a whole different light, and I've been encouraging them to make phone calls while we're sheltering in place to those people who might be on the fringe or might be worried or might be lonely. We have quite a few widows, widowers. They're part of our extended family, and even more so now because of all that's happening. You know, it's not like this is down the road 50, 60 miles. No, this is right here in town. This is the one of them is the maintenance superintendent there at the school. You know, the kids go to school with them all the time. I was a little concerned that our kids wouldn't take this serious, but when one of the juniors in the high school came down with it, it's made us take this serious, and everybody's taken all the precautions that they're supposed to. It's changed the way we are normally used to living.
When you say change the way you've lived, what do you mean? People aren't, I assume, they're not out and about, not going to stores?
That's right, and we're a very mobile community. We're always busy. We're always trying to do for each other and do for ourselves, too. And I think this has helped us to correct some of that and maybe put ourselves second.
As a religious leader in the community, what's it been like for you personally? I mean, have parishioners come to you with concerns, fears, requests for prayers, that kind of thing?
We had our last Mass on Wednesday, the 18th of March. That night we were told we wouldn't be able to have Mass again. And I think for our elderly people who've lived through the Dust Bowl and all of that, all those calamities, this was their biggest concern. They've never in their life been told they can't go to church. And, you know, by the end of that week, we had three people in the hospital, you know, who had tested positive for this virus. And the panic and the fear, and I was asked, can you give us some kind of spiritual direction? I said, well, I would be happy to. So I've been doing reflections on the Sunday Gospels. I did a video last week that one of the parishioners helped me with. We're planning to do one this afternoon as well on how to do a Holy Week in your house. We rally around the church on Holy Week. All that's been put on hold. So I'm coming up with some ideas of how we can do this in the home and make this one of the most memorable Holy Weeks that we'll probably remember in our lives. So just trying to calm some fears and trying to give them some things that they can keep in their heart, not only for the parents, but also for the kids. You know, this is cramping their style too. They're always out and about, and not going to school now is really hard on them, but give them some things to think about, things to do in the home that can take the place of those things. hopefully, David, on the end of this, and this is what I've said since the beginning, if this blows over and we get past this and we just go back to business as usual, that would be the greater tragedy. I think the Lord is trying to tell us, you know, you've forgotten me. You know, you've come become a society, and I wrote this in one of my reflections, you become a society that relies only on yourself. And in Nazareth, you know, we excel in sports, we excel academically, we excel in our careers, but there's a fine line between that, you know, between confidence in what you do and pride. And all these things are simply gift from God to us. And so I hope we remember that. We're not in control. If we get to the end of this and we've made some new habits that have formed in the house, you know, due to praying as a family and looking out for each other as a family, and then extending that beyond the doors of our house, then I think we got God's message out of this. Otherwise, if we just go back to business as usual, then we've missed the message.
Bob Birkenfeld is a deacon at Holy Family Catholic Church in Nazareth, a small community in the Panhandle that's been profoundly affected by the coronavirus. Deacon Birkenfeld, thanks for joining us on the Texas Standard, and happy Easter to you and yours.
And thank you, David, and the same to you. Happy Easter.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
I'm Alex Abbott. I'm a native Texan, born in Houston and living in Austin now for 25 years. I, a few years ago, started doing chalkboard drawings at my kids' school. And so we haven't had school, and I've been drawing with chalk in my driveway. And I feel like you've got your social media feeds, and but you can't communicate so much, right? You know, I can't really go to H-E-B and give everybody a handshake and a high five and everything, but they're on my mind, and so it's kind of a thank you. I don't know if they'll find out about it or not. It is based on a Loteria card. It's not my idea. I saw it, you know, reposted by somebody else, but basically it is the I mean, it's like an Atlas figure, but it's usually a muscular guy holding up the whole world. In this case, the guy is wearing his H-E-B t-shirt and some jeans, and he's holding up the whole world. And so there's kind of some stars around it and a little, if you can find Texas on the world, and my map skills are pretty bad, there's a big heart where the Texas is. But anyway, the H-E-B guy is holding us up. Like, there's a couple baggers that always chat me up each time. I think the guy's name is Julian, but he's super sweet. And it's like, he's the one that's there when it's the OU game and you don't have ice. Or it's the day before Halloween and you don't have candy. Or it's, you know, I work at a school. I get the whole week of Thanksgiving off. But that Wednesday before Thanksgiving, he's still there. And he's still friendly, and he still chats me up. And, you know, if the kids are there, and it's 2 days before Christmas, and again, it's last minute, he's just perpetually friendly. You know, when school is gone, and work is gone, and for a lot of people, church is gone, and, you know, my boy's soccer is gone, and it's like, you know, they're still there over there. It's pretty awesome. Everybody needs a little more beauty and a little show of solidarity and empathy. I guess that's what I was hoping for. This is Alex Abbott, drawing with chalk in my driveway. And you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Past the hour, Texas Standard time. I'm David Brown. Value is almost always relative, right? You've heard the expression, one person's trash is another's treasure. Today, the Texas Standard's Michael Marks brings us a story that underscores that and the lengths some will go to hold on to what's important to them.
Trees are scarce in the Texas Panhandle. Big trees are even scarcer.
To me, trees are sacred in this part of the world. We just don't have very many.
That's Lacey Cotter-Vardaman. She raises cattle and cotton on two parcels of land in the Panhandle, one in Lubbock County, another in Bailey County.
About 10 miles from the Texas-New Mexico border.
She started buying land in Bailey County about 25 years ago. A few times a week, she and her three kids would drive the hour and a half between her two properties. It's not the most scenic route. Mostly flat pastures and irrigation pivots. But there was one site that the Vardamans always looked forward to toward the end of the drive.
We used him as a landmark just because he was so big.
He is an elm tree, a thick one, about 7 feet around, with long arcing branches that scraped the tops of trucks and trailers. The tree sat on the fence line of a neighbor's property. Vardaman thought that it was at least 130 years old. It's referenced in journals by early settlers of the county. And there's nothing else like it for miles.
My kids, they always call this tree the mayor of Baileyboro. Baileyboro's just basically a cemetery. He was just huge and pretty, and there were a lot of deer under him a lot of times. And there's no telling what all has lived in him and under him for all of those years.
The mayor belonged to a different timeline than us humans. He was there before the Vardamans, and they thought he'd be there long after them. But one day, a couple weeks ago, Lacey got a call from her daughter, Molly, who was driving to the Bailey County property to pick up a few of her things.
I was on my phone with my mom because I was super excited. I got accepted into the master's program of accounting at Lubbock Christian University.
But as she neared the property, rounding the curve where the mayor comes into view, her excitement faded.
I pulled around and the tree was on its side and was like, "Ah, man."
The tree's owners cut it down. Vardaman said they wanted to build a new fence and the mayor was in the way. It had practically absorbed one of the old T-posts.
I didn't know anything about it till it was too late, so I couldn't have done anything. He wasn't on my property, but just couldn't believe somebody cut down a tree.
Lacey hung up with Molly. 5 minutes passed. Then she picked up the phone again and called her neighbors.
I just figured, I'll call and ask if I can at least have a piece of him.
They said that was fine. They just planned to cut up the tree and burn it anyway. If Lacey could haul it, she could have it. So she did.
I have a very large John Deere loader, and we had to cut a lot of the bigger branches off of him because it was so heavy, my loader wasn't able to pick it up.
A few other neighbors stopped by to say they appreciated her saving what she could of the tree. It seemed like a shame not to, even if it was hard work. After cutting the mare down to size, she loaded it onto a 34-foot trailer.
It kind of took up most of it. I think we decided he weighed over 10,000 pounds, the part that I actually brought home.
Which is where it is now, sitting by her haystack, waiting for what's next. Replanting isn't possible, so Lacey plans to give some of the wood to each of her kids. She's looking for a carpenter to make rough-cut tables out of it, somewhere where people could gather, share a meal. For Molly, it's a way to show reverence for something that persevered for so long in a place where it can be so hard to stay alive.
It's amazing to think that this tree has gone through World War I, World War II, the Dust Bowl. It's gone and seen all of the hard times and good times of the area. And I'm really impressed that things are able to live and last that long, especially in as hard of an area as it is around here.
So the mayor will not go to waste. For years, the tree was how the Vardamans knew they were close to home. Now, it will always have a place in theirs. For the Texas Standard, I'm Michael Marks.
Well, you know, with lockdown and all, residents at the Enclave, a senior living center in Round Rock, were looking for a way to bump up the bingo night excitement recently. Got a whole lot cooler all of a sudden when a certain Oscar-winning Texan offered to join in the fun. Bingo! Matthew McConaughey, his wife Camilla, and mom Kay dropped in by video chat to call out the numbers. You know, things have been rocking of late at the Enclave. Last week, the home hosted a dance party with help from North Austin Music Therapy, encouraging residents to dance along on their patios. Coming up on 49 minutes past the hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be responsible world citizens. More on how a trip to Norway challenged students' perspectives on mass incarceration and justice at tcu.edu/stories. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Since last fall, the U.S. has sent more than 800 asylum seekers to Guatemala, but not all being sent there are actually from Guatemala. The program has been temporarily suspended because of COVID-19 concerns, but that still leaves many asylum seekers from neighboring countries stuck far from home and wondering what their next move will be. Lauren Madelon reports now from Guatemala City.
It's just after dawn. People are crowded around a cell phone charging station at the Casa del Migrante, a migrant shelter. Their faces paint a harrowing tableau, a mosaic of confusion and anger at the same time. Natalia Medina is one of them.
I didn't know what was going on.
Medina is still trying to find her bearings. She's a high school English teacher from Tegucigalpa, the capital of Honduras. Along with El Salvador and Guatemala, the three nations comprise Central America's Northern Triangle, where parallel states run by organized crime sow continual terror. She'd hoped to leave this area to join family in Texas. It didn't work out.
It was a mess.
She'd been taken from the U.S. Border Patrol Central Processing Center in McAllen the night before, just before midnight, and put on a bus.
We stayed right there, sitting down, without moving, in handcuffs, all the time.
5 hours later, Medina and the others from El Salvador and Honduras were on a nonstop flight to Guatemala.
Did you have to wear the handcuff in the flight?
Yes.
She says the flight itself was smooth, but the mood, tense.
When did the handcuffs come off your hands?
15 minutes or 20 minutes after we arrived to Guatemala.
Medina is here because of a U.S. policy that targets asylum seekers from El Salvador and Honduras. Others on that flight stated emphatically they were completely surprised to find themselves in Guatemala. Like others I spoke with, Medina believed she could still apply for U.S. asylum from here.
And they said, yes, you're going to continue with that in Guatemala. Because I thought that it was going to be possible to have like an asylum here in Guatemala and then going back to the States. But it was like a totally a lie.
I asked Medina specifically, what exactly were you told before the flight? She said it was clear to her, after speaking in English to Department of Homeland Security personnel in McAllen before the flight, that she could move forward with her U.S. asylum application once she got here. In an email, a DHS spokesperson writes, quote, at no point are migrants told they can wait in Guatemala for U.S. asylum. Medina's disappointed on hearing that.
I guess that I misunderstood or they didn't explain me very well.
Guatemalan human rights defender Kelvin Jimenez believes the U.S. policy is short-sighted. He says it's foolish to believe people fleeing chaos in other parts of Central America will stay here.
The United States is sending these people to Guatemala, a country that cannot protect its own citizens. So it is not a good thing to send anyone here.
Now that Medina's been sent here, she has 3 days to decide if she'll apply to remain. She's already decided. She won't. But unlike the vast majority who say they're going to head to the U.S. again, Natalia says that for her, that dream is over.
I will think twice to go back to the States because I don't want to happen the situations that happened to me in jail.
She says she was in two detention centers for a total of 9 days.
I don't want to go back again.
She alleges some DHS officers in the migrant detention centers in Texas humiliated her and others regularly as they ate or if they asked to have a shower.
And I could perceive that they didn't want us to be there. I have never felt depressed before, and I have been feeling depression just because I was in jail.
For now, she's leaving for Tegucigalpa in a few hours.
How they can send me to a place that is more dangerous than my country, Honduras. How is it possible?
Honduras is statistically just slightly more violent than Guatemala. But for people like Medina, that's a meaningless difference. The policy that sent Medina here is under challenge in U.S. federal court. Under federal law and international treaty obligations, the U.S. can't force people to go to countries where they'll be in danger. I'm Lorne Madelon in Guatemala City.
And you were listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar, how you holding out, man?
Pretty good, pretty good. How you doing, David?
I'm doing all right. Social media is popping. Hey, I don't know if you've been to texasstandard.org recently, but have you seen that new map?
Yeah, pretty cool thing. We have a couple of maps showing the outbreak of COVID-19 across Texas. One displaying deaths, one displaying just cases on a county-by-county basis. So some very very fascinating work there by our friends at KERA that put that data together, and we are sharing it with our statewide audience. They're very proud about that. Folks can go to texasstandard.org and check it out for the latest there, being updated daily, my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Monitoring a story coming out of Texas City along Galveston Bay, where a large COVID-19 outbreak at a nursing home is subject to some controversial treatment. I think you may have heard about this one, David. Here's the story. Governor Greg Abbott, he raised eyebrows yesterday when he announced that some 30 residents of the resort at Texas City that tested positive for COVID-19 are being treated with hydroxychloroquine. It isn't a new drug. Hydroxychloroquine has been around for quite some time. However, it's still largely untested for coronavirus and can prompt some serious side effects. But still, that hasn't stopped several right-wing commentators and President Trump himself from touting it as a potential treatment for coronavirus. Adding to the story here, David, is this revelation first reported by the Texas Tribune that the nursing home doctor treating the patients, a one Robin Armstrong, happens to be a national advocate for Trump and is one of Texas' two members to the Republican National Committee, raising some interesting questions about where the politics stops and the medical treatment options begin in this instance. So this one prompting dozens of comments on our Facebook page. Vince Hubert says, this is not the right way to do science. This is what a reality TV star would do. However, Kim Nahara says, this is not some new drug. It's been used to treat other diseases. If they need trials, do so with consent. We're running out of options. If I had COVID-19 and was struggling, I would help. I would take a chance to help save my life. Other dimensions here, David, as well, though. Fascinating stuff. Byron McCauley, he says the major issue with all this, in his opinion, is the administration stockpiling 29 million doses of a drug that people with lupus desperately need and must take daily. So now some people are having major problems filling their legitimate prescriptions, Byron points out. And lastly, Pat Snow, he notes... Pat says that he hopes those nursing home patients hold up all right. And he adds, now I'm reading that Trump has a financial interest in the drug maker. Does anyone care? Pat alluding there to a report in the New York Times yesterday that Trump has what's described as a small financial stake in the maker of hydroxychloroquine in terms of stock ownership. So obviously a developing story, one that plenty of folks are talking about on social media.
I can imagine. I don't know if you're seeing this other story that the Dallas Morning News has on FEMA rejecting Texas's disaster request. This over Dallas's October tornadoes, denying the region millions of dollars. Apparently, Governor Greg Abbott's office will appeal this rejection. Alas, we're out of time for the big broadcast, but keep your comments coming at Texas Standard. You know where to find us on social media. Wells Dunbar is always looking for you. He'll be back here tomorrow. I'll be back here tomorrow. We hope you will join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.